All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Tonight, I'm here with a few of our regulars. First of all, sitting at my side is the lovely Zilpha.
Hello.
And way back in Zion is the lovely Tom.
Lovely?
Yeah. You're looking good from here too, John.
Thanks.
Yeah, hey, how's it going, brother. Guys?
And we also have the one and only controversial Mike from Las Vegas. How are you doing, Mike?
Hello.
And we also have our new friend Glenn Ostlund in Japan. How are you, Glenn?
I'm good. I notice I'm always Glenn Ostlund. My sister says, you know, they always say your last name when you're on.
I
could be just Glenn.
I always say my last name. Do you want it or not?
Okay. It's fine. I just want to get to a point where you tell me I'm looking good sitting here.
Don't try to take that spot. I earned that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. All right. So tonight we are doing kind of the second half of a discussion that Glenn started with Dr. Benite on the 10 tribes. In that recording, which we'll be posting at the same time of this one, Dr. Benite covers a lot of the foundation and history of the mythos behind the Lost Ten Tribes, both from a Mormon point of view, which he touches on, and you know, throughout its entire history. Fascinating book, which I had the pleasure to read. Glenn, offhand, do you remember what the title of the book is? It's just The Lost Ten Tribes, isn't it?
It's The Ten Lost Tribes.
Oh, yes.
World History.
I recommend everybody pick it up. We'll have a link to it on the website. We want to do the second half of the interview to kind of dig a little bit deeper down into the Mormon view of the Lost Ten Tribes and sort of what Mormons believe and what they don't believe and what's in between. So let's get started, first of all, and kind of take a look at, well, what do Mormons believe about the Lost Ten Tribes? Glenn, you, this is kind of up your alley. You want to start us out?
Well, I mean, I can talk about when I was growing up, I was one of those guys that was always interested in the mysteries of the church, you know, those kind of hidden occult things I wanted to figure out. And I'd sit in meetings and listen to prayers and go into the temple and trying to put all these pieces together, what it meant. And the Lost Tribes was absolutely one of these occult kind of things. You know, they're this lost group of people and they're supposed to come back. And you know, one of the sources of information in these mysteries for me was McConkie's Mormon Doctrine. And so I'd turn to Lost Tribes and I'd study everything that was in there. And James E. Talmadge gave this prophecy in 1916 that said that the Lost Tribes are going to return exactly as it's prophesied in the DNC, where, you know, they come from the north and they break down the ice and a highway comes up, and that when they come back, they'll bring these treasures with them. And these treasures will be the records that are similar to the Nephite record, you know, similar to the golden plates that talk about Christ's visit among their people during the meridian of time. And, you know, the Book of Mormon has this reference that says, now I'm going to go to talk to the Lost Tribes. And so we're going to get to hear that story. So in 1916, Talmadge says this in a general conference to everybody, and he says, and, you know, I testify that there are those present in this congregation who will live to read the words that the Lost Tribes bring back with them.
Man, they always regret saying stuff like that.
Yeah, they don't make that mistake anymore.
They don't do that anymore, but that was exciting. You know, so as a kid, I'd get in there and I was a amateur ethnologist where, you know, I would try and look at the different customs of different places around the world to see, oh, maybe, you know, maybe what they're doing is similar to the Lost Tribes. That could be the Lost Tribes. And you know, growing up when I did, which, you know, I think most of us are about the same age, when you've got Russia as this big scary thing in the Reagan era, and then all of a sudden the wall comes down and missionaries start going in. And I think missionaries started going in maybe the year or so before I got my mission call. And I thought, yeah, that would be cool, because the Russians, they're going to be the Lost Tribes, because that's the North.
The North Country.
Yeah. And then I got my mission call to Japan and was a little bit disappointed. I should probably also say that my patriarchal blessing has a line that says, get to know your brethren of the other tribes, for in due time you'll come to learn of them and to work with their culture. And so, you know, I was set up. I was,
so
was going to be
thought
a,
you
a
were
star.
Teach the lost tribes. And when you talk to Cabo,
yeah,
on your in your interview, and he was mentioning how he has a belief that the that some of the lost tribes at least are in Japan.
Yeah, there's a there are groups of people, not just Mormons, that share that belief. And that was something when I started studying folklore, I started getting interested in all of these things that I heard when I was a missionary. You know, and I first heard it when I was in the MTC. They said, you know, I had a teacher who was Japanese, and she drew a torii gate on the chalkboard. And the torii gate, I don't know how to describe it, is the two pillars and then the kind of upturned ends on the top. And it's usually red, and you see them in front of a Shinto shrine.
Yeah.
And she told us that this torii gate is a clue. And the reason that it's red, they're always red. She said they're not, but they're always red. She said, because it's a remembrance of the blood that the Israelites painted on the side posts and the mantelpiece during the Passover. You know, you remember that story of the Passover where they slaughtered a lamb and they put the blood on the door and on the top so that the smoke monster from Lost.
It seems to me that whenever there's a new group that kind of comes into the fold of Christianity, there's an effort made to include them in the narrative of the Bible. Because I think if you went to like the islands, they would have similar kind of stories of them being either part of the lost tribes or at least Israelites. I mean, everybody wants to fit into this story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right on.
Yeah, you know, I served my mission among Southeast Asians, and the same sort of myths and different things appeared there. And there were missionaries who would dig through old, you know, Buddhist texts and try to draw a line between that and Christianity. And there was a tribe from the hills of Laos and Vietnam called the Hmong. And they had some symbology dealing with their own zodiac, which, of course, you know, the year has 12 months. So that, of course, was proof that they believed they were from the 12 tribes and you know, and stuff like that. So I think that sort of drawing whatever people you want to
and then searching for the little pieces of things that might be evidence.
Yeah, I mean, any culture is so big that if you put two cultures next to each other, say the Hebrews and the Maya, you're gonna find similarities. But I think that goes for any two cultures. There's only, you know, we share a lot of the same common experiences, like the same calendar
and the same genetics. So we have similar ways of being and interpreting the world.
Hey, Glenn, when you mentioned that in your patriarchal blessing talks about the 10 or the lost tribes or whatever. Yeah, I think mine only mentions that I'm from Ephraim. That's about it.
You know, and the funny thing there is Ephraim is the lost 10 tribes, right? Or, you know, the North Kingdom was referred to as Ephraim during the time. But although all Mormons generally are of the tribe of Ephraim or Manasseh in their patriarchal blessings, I never hear the LDS people refer to themselves as the lost 10 tribes. The lost 10 tribes are an other.
Is Ephraim and Manasseh, are those the two that are not lost? Is that what it is?
No, the two that aren't lost are Judah and Dan.
Okay.
So is it Judah and Dan or Judah and Benjamin?
Oh, Judah,
I hear
Benjamin.
It two ways.
Well, and I have to tip my hand. I mean, I believe it's mostly a mythological. You know, there was the North Kingdom. It was clear, and just like Dr. Benite talks about, they were sacked and there were people carried off. But it's clear from archaeological evidence they weren't all carried off, and the tribes probably more were a myth to explain the geopolitical breakdown of the area, as opposed to like real living people. Like there most likely wasn't a Dan and a Benjamin and these guys who sang in that musical.
There probably were, but by the time the North, the Assyrians came and sacked the the 10 tribes, it wasn't going to be clear distinctions between the groups. I mean, they all would have intermarried, and it doesn't make sense to me that they would have been all these 10 distinct tribes.
I don't know. If they would have intermarried, I think we would have seen another flood.
Another Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the mythos that Dr. Benite talks about is that, and of course we've all encountered in the scriptures, is the Babylonian captivity. The Babylonian captivity only refers to the kingdom of Judah, but earlier in what year was it, 700 or somewhere around there?
721 is usually when they're said to have been carried away, the 10 lost tribes.
So the north kingdom is sacked, the people are all carried away into Assyria, and then somehow, which I'm not always clear on, the 10 tribes repent and become righteous, and together as a group, they wander off into the north countries and cross the mythical river and are lost from historical time and space.
Yeah, Orson Pratt, here's a quote from him talking about that. When he talks about the highway coming up, and then they come back, and he said, "But where have this great company been? Where has this mighty host come from? They have come from their hiding place in the north country. They have been led thence by the prophets of the Most High God, the Lord going before their camp, talking with them out of the cloud, as he talked in ancient days with the camp of Israel, uttering his voice before his army, for his camp will be very great." So his interpretation is kind of the... Well, what Dr. Benite, he talked about the reverse exile.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the...
Well, you know, I mean, even as a kid, when I would read stuff like this, I would think, if they're lost and we don't know anything about them, how did we find out that they took this journey? You know, how do we know that they repented and they went off as a group? Where's that information coming from? And I kind of posed that question to Dr. Benite, and basically, you know, you've got the North Kingdom that was carried off in 721 BC, but you still had, you know, the Southern Kingdom of Judah that were, you know, kept the tradition and the memory alive of, you know, their brethren who had been taken away and they'd been lost, and this is when you have Isaiah and these other prophets prophesying that the tribes will return. But they weren't thinking of, like, in the end days millennial return. They were thinking, you know, yeah, they're going to come back and we're going to be together as a people again. You know, there's this power in loss and reunification. But then what ended up happening is that Babylon came in and sacked Judah and carried Judah away. And that's when you have all of the stories about, you know, Meshach and Abednego and Daniel and the lion's den, whatever, they're in Babylonian captivity. Then that southern kingdom is released from Babylonian captivity, and there had been a popular knowledge that when they returned to the land of Jerusalem, they would return intact as a whole with their brethren of the other 10 tribes. And so when that didn't happen, when it was just the southern kingdom that returned, they were left with this question, you know, why was this prophecy not fulfilled? Why have these tribes not returned? And so at some point, there was a prophet named Esdras who Dr. Benite said, we're not really sure what this person's name was, but he was writing as if he was Esdras, as if it was 400 years ago, and he was telling the story of you know, what happened to the lost tribes, that they repented, and then they took this journey of a year and a half, and they crossed a river that God stopped the flood, you know, the way that he split the Red Sea for Moses, and, you know, so many other times he does this in the Bible. And so this book of Second Esdras, which now is considered an apocryphal book, it's not part of the canon of the Old Testament, it tells the story, or it hints at the migration of the lost tribes into the lands of the north. But it was a way of that southern kingdom of Judah to reconcile their lack of fulfillment for that prophecy. And from then, you know, so that Dr. Benite talks about two losses. You know, the first loss of the tribes was when Assyria took them over. And the second loss of the tribes is when they didn't come back when they were supposed to. And so now where are they? And that's really when a lot of the mythos started growing up around them, and when their return would be and what that actually would mean. And there are whole sections of the book, if you get the book and read it, that you can see in the Middle Ages, guys like Prester John, who is supposed to be a king of the tribes, or has dealings with the tribes, that, and, you know, comes back and has all of these records that the tribes are out there and they're interacting with people and they're at the edge of the world and they're protecting the world from all of the disasters that are, you know, right at our doorstep. And all of this kind of romantic folklore and mythology attached itself to this tribe story. And people other than the Jews started adopting it into their overall narrative. And that's where, you know, in the Christians mythology, it becomes really important. And I think for Mormons, and getting back to one of the earlier questions about Ephraim being the lost tribes, there was a guy, George Reynolds, who wrote a book called We Are of Israel. And he describes this apocryphal journey of Edris's group as they're going up north. And he supposes, you know, he extrapolates from what he knows of the Book of Mormon, that there are rebellious brothers, Laman and Lemuel, that there must also have been their counterparts, these rebellious people of the lost tribes. And who is more likely to be rebellious than the proud tribe of Ephraim? So as they're taking their journey north, and they're generally considered at someplace in the North Pole, as they're making their journey north, the rebellious Ephraim must have backslided and mingled in with the indigenous peoples of Northern Europe and the British Isles. And that's why you have so much blood of Israel in the church, because of the influx of converts from England and from Europe, all being told that they're from Ephraim. So they did have a very literal belief that they were lost tribes, but they weren't the lost tribes. You know, they were just Ephraim. And there's this blessing that Jacob gives to all of his sons, and gives a blessing to Ephraim about this vine that's spread over a wall. And I've never understood it, but it's always been used to define Ephraim's role in the gathering process. So Ephraim's the leader, and Ephraim's the one that's charged with getting the rest of the tribes together and finally bringing this restoration after, you know, all these thousands of years of being apart. And there'll be the new Jerusalem, and the Zion, you know, the spiritual center in the old world, and the political center in, you know, Jackson County, Missouri, and in Zion.
Well, that's how
it fit for the early church members. I've been talking a lot.
Well, for them, it was very literal. I mean, I know of several instances where Heber Kimball taught about the people of England being of a more pure, almost a racist teaching, being of a more pure blood in that connection. And Brigham Young actually said at one time, I think it's in the Journal of Discourse, Volume 2, if I remember right, Brigham Young said that Joseph Smith was of the pure blood of Ephraim, that so he could trace himself all the way back. So, that was prevalent.
So when we talk about let's
get talk about where they are.
Well, let's go into what the climate, what the beliefs were when Joseph Smith.
Wait, before we go there, I want to take and level set and go back to what the Mormons necessarily believe about the 12 tribes. So let's go back and
right
look at
now,
the,
or yeah. starting from the beginning of Mormonism.
I want to go back to the Book of Mormon. So, you know, one thing in all this mythology is that the debate goes on as to whether they're literal or they are figurative, whether they've spread in and just intermixed with the local peoples, or whether they are literal people. And you talked about sort of the Laman and Lemuel mythology. Interesting what the Book of Mormon has to say about it, because it names them as a distinctive group in several passages. And I know in the Book of Mormon, after Jesus returns, and they riff on the passage in the New Testament that talks about other, sheep I have, which most Christians would interpret to mean the Gentiles, but the Mormons have said that refers to the Book of Mormon people. But like in 3 Nephi 17:4, Jesus says, "But now I go unto the Father, and also to show myself unto the lost tribes of Israel, for they are not lost unto the Father, for he knoweth whither he hath taken them." And 3 Nephi 21:26, "And then shall the work of the Father commence at that day, even when the gospel shall be preached among the remnant of this people. Verily I say unto you, at that day shall the work of the Father commence among all the dispersed of my people, yea, even the tribes which have been lost, which the Father hath led away out of Jerusalem." So, and of course, you know, Christ saying that he's visited these people. Now he's going to go visit the other tribes, and that they each have a record, the record of the Book of Mormonish people, but there is a record of the 10 tribes people that they're going to get. And the Doctrine and Covenants makes clear that John, the Baptist, not John the Baptist, John the Revelator, is among them. And if we read in D&C 77, 9, "What are we to understand by the angel ascending from the east, Revelation 7, chapter and second verse? We are to understand that the angel ascended from the east from the east is he to whom is given the seal of the living God over the 12 tribes of Israel. Wherefore he crieth unto the four angels having the everlasting gospel, saying, Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their forehead. And if you receive it, this is Elias, which was to come together the tribes of Israel and restore all things." And verse 11, "What are we to understand by sealing the 144,000 out of all the tribes of Israel? We are to understand that those who are sealed are high priests ordained unto the Holy God to minister the everlasting gospel, for they are who ordained," blah, 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 blah. And then verse 14, this is the more interesting one. "What do we understand by the little book which was eaten by John?" Mentioned the 10th chapter of Revelation. "We are to understand there was a mission and an ordinance for him to gather all the tribes of Israel. Behold, this is Elias who has written, must come and restore all things." So I think it's clear that from Mormon theology, Mormon scriptures, that the 12 tribes or the 10 tribes are distinct people, that Jesus visited them, and that John the Revelator is among them.
Oh, and one more thing. In the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, it says the Book of Mormon prophets affirmed that the Lord had not forgotten the 10 tribes and that they are keeping records that will yet be revealed. That was in 2 Nephi 29, 12-14. So they've got all kinds of records, too. So
that's the scriptures. Can we get into the fun stuff now?
So, yeah, the next question is, of course, where...
Mike, are you going to sit down and let her say that?
So Mike, you've been quiet. Where are the 10 tribes?
Well, they're scattered all about. I mean, I don't think they're in one place.
Should we break down what the theories are?
Yeah.
Dr. Benite talked about that a little bit, I know, and he says there's one where they're still lost, like they could be in the lost city of Atlantis or under the water or near the core of the earth or stuff like that. I've heard lots of those. And the other one that like Mike was talking about, they're here. They're not technically lost, like in a certain location. They're just spread amongst us. And then of course the other one is that the 10 tribes is just a farce anyway.
Well, and then there's another one. This is from James E. Talmage in his Articles of Faith book. He says, "While many of those belonging to the 10 tribes were diffused among the nations, a significant number to justify the retention of the original name were led away as a body and are now in existence someplace where the Lord has hidden them." So that's like a mixture where, yeah, they're spread out amongst the nations, but there is still some portion of them that are going to return in a group to fulfill these prophecies.
Yeah, they have to.
And I've heard, and I think even Glenn, you mentioned in your discussion with Dr. Benite that even they could be on different worlds, because I've heard those theories from Mormons too, on different worlds, like in outer space or
Joseph
whatever.
Would point up to the sky and say, you know, you see that star, that's the North Star, and if you go down, you know, to that star there, that's the lost tribes, and when they come back, there's going to be this huge collision. And you know the earth will reel to and fro like a drunken man.
Yeah, a portion of the earth was.
Mike, you don't believe
off.
that the uh, that there is going to be a literal return of the Lost Tribes?
Well, yeah, there will be, but let's look at Doctrine and Covenants 133, verse 26 through 29. It says, and there are they who are in the north country shall come in remembrance before the Lord, and their prophets shall hear his voice, and shall no longer stay themselves, and they shall smite the rocks, and the ice shall flow down at their presence, and a highway shall be cast up in the midst of the great deep, and their enemies shall become prey unto them. Isaiah's using figurative language here like he likes to do so much, like you said, with the branches and the trees and things. But if you look in Isaiah 35, he says something similar, and you get a better idea of what he's saying. He says, then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing, for in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert, and the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. Let's skip ahead.
So Mike, what's just summarize? What's your take? What's your opinion?
Well, what doctrine's going to come forth that gives these lost people their identity? They're going to come to an understanding of the doctrines of Christ, and they're going to understand who they are as a people, and then they can return and claim their heritage and birthright. But
so you
know, they go out and get dispersed, and they're all over the place.
Well, it'll be a dribbling, right now, right? A dribbling return instead of an en masse return?
Well, there will eventually be a mass return. We're in the middle of a dribbling return right now when our missionaries go out and they're gathering scattered Israel in. So there'll be a great return, but we're in an early stage right now.
Mike, you don't believe that there's like this place on the earth where all the tribes are together currently living?
No, that's the point I was trying to make. This highway cut in the deep.
Liberal.
Is Isaiah's language is going to be a flow of revelation and doctrine that gives these people back their identity. It's not a literal earth opening up and there's this great highway and they're going to come marching up the highway, up the road or something.
You're kind of a cafeteria Mormon is what you're saying.
No, I'm not a cafeteria Mormon.
What do you think of Mike? What do you think about the other theory that, you know, that there's some city underneath the ocean somewhere where all these tribes are? You think that's hocus pocus or what?
I think that's bogus.
So
what do you think about Talmage prophesying in 1916 that they're going, in General Conference, that they're going to return and they're going to bring the records with them, and that there are people there in that congregation who will read them with their own eyes?
Well, I think we are going to get a lot more scripture coming out. I mean, but I don't think it's like they're all down in some basement somewhere with their library and, hey, come look at my library.
Okay,
I think when they come gathering in, we're going to get more scripture of what happened to these people.
So normally we beat Mike up for believing weird things, and now we're beating him up for not believing weird things.
Yeah, come on, Mike.
Come on,
Mike. With the program.
Okay, so let's. So I happen to know somebody, Zilpha, your father.
Oh, yeah.
He believes that the Lost Tribes are in the middle of the earth.
The center of the earth.
The earth is hollow. And he has shown me maps, and you can search this on the web. There's actually quite a few people, both inside and outside Mormonism, who believe this.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of them believe that there's a hole in the North Pole where they will come marching out. Now, Glenn, didn't you send me a link earlier today?
I'm staring at it right now. It's voyagehollowearth.com.
For a mere $20,000.
Yeah.
What?
You can join this, and if I read the website right, it sounds like the guy who was forming it passed away, unfortunately.
They charged $20,000 to join their coalition.
Well, they had to rent a Russian icebreaker.
It's between $18,950 to $20,950. So it depends on what kind of meals you want to eat on the ship, I guess.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the point
is, entertainment.
They believe it literally that the 12 tribes are in the North Pole, and I actually posted on the Mormon apologetics site, thanks guys, about 2 weeks ago, a little poll where I asked them where the 10 tribes are. And the breakdown was 7% said they are together in the north on the earth. And some of the people who respond to that talked about global warming is actually going to loosen these guys up, and then they're going to be able to come marching out.
Well, they're frozen.
Like Godzilla.
Yeah, 12% said they're together on the earth in an unknown place. So, and Glenn, you mentioned this earlier. When I was a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, it was easy to place them behind the Iron Curtain because that was mysterious to us, that we all believed that once the Iron Curtain fell and the missionaries went into the Soviet bloc, that then we would find the 10 tribes where John was among them.
So you guys would agree that that was like the popular teaching for you guys growing up?
Yeah. You talk about
us. For me, it was. And the most exciting thing was that they've got a city called Samarkand, which sounds like Samaria, which was the capital city of the lost tribe. So it's also something that the Japanese use for samurai to say, yeah, they're connected there. But yeah, I thought that Russia was going to be it.
Well, you know, I guess because I grew up.
The walls coming down was prophecy being fulfilled. Absolutely.
I grew up with the Hollow Earth. Have to say,
yeah.
So, or perhaps the other planet somewhere in
I grew up with the under the ocean, like the city of Atlantis, and they would all just come up out, you know, on some beach somewhere
on the highway from the Sea of the Deep. Now, in my little unscientific poll, I only had one person who said they are together in a separate place from the Earth.
Wow!
But I want to explore that idea a little bit more because this one, actually, of all of them, has the most traction. For legitimate Mormon doctrine. Now, if we understand Mormon doctrine, we know about the city of Enoch. We talked about that in the Pearl Great Prize, where there was this land mass, and the people were so righteous that it was removed from the earth. So there's precedence for people being removed from the earth.
It happened right after they passed their health care bill, I think.
Oh, jeez.
Well, there was even a hymn written by Eliza R. Snow. It was in the hymn book until 1905, I think.
Yes, I think so.
And she talks about how the earth was once a great big, huge, huge sphere.
The Pangea.
Yeah.
No, the
earth itself was bigger. And then it had been torn asunder piece by piece. When Enoch could no longer stay amid corruption here, part of thyself, the earth, was bone away to form another sphere. So when Enoch was taken away, it was actually a portion of the earth taken into outer space. And then when the Lord saw fit to hide the 10 lost tribes away, thou earth wast severed to provide the orb on which they stay. And she compares it to, she says, so, you know, the earth is sacrificing itself, like kind of like Christ.
The real question is was that a good tune or not?
I couldn't find the music for it. I was disappointed.
You couldn't?
No.
So
I'd have to order that hymn book, which I haven't done yet.
And so they're saying that part of the tribes of Israel were taken away, like the city of Enoch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the planet was actually separated, the out of the north. And what the teaching is now let's go back. There's another teaching that a lot of people in the church believe, and that's that the Earth was physically separated away from the Kolobian orbit when it fell into its mortality. That the Earth spun around the Kolob with whatever planet God is on, while Adam and Eve were in the garden. That's when it was in its celestial state, and it was removed to this terrestrial state. And at the end, the earth will be slid back into place.
And then these pieces will kind of join up. And supposedly Joseph Smith described it as, say they're both moving. One's just moving just slightly faster than the other one. So when they kind of run into each other, they kind of slide into place. So that it's not like going to break the whole earth apart, but they'll just kind of slide into place.
Okay. Mike.
Yes, go ahead.
Before I just start busting up, do you buy much of that, bro? I mean, I just got to know before I just start laughing, I guess.
I don't see the Earth going back over to go into orbit, a celestial orbit. I don't see the gospel plan working like that. I can understand God moving and organizing the chaotic matter to form worlds like the one we live on, and we just perfect it here. It doesn't make sense to me for us to travel back to where God lives.
So you're saying that
celestialized where we are.
So you don't think any pieces
fracking crazy
broke off of the earth?
it doesn't make doctrinal sense for us to have a big celestial orbit around where God lives. I see God organizing as He expands.
Well, put that part away. What about the pieces of earth with the tribes on them? Getting,
well, we know
Enoch
the city of Enoch was taken up. The
okay,
city
so that was the physical. But they're not saying translated. They're saying it was broken off, taken into outer space, and they live there now. And it will return, and they will live back on Earth again.
Well, see, now you're getting into where do translated beings live, like all the translated beings that came and saw Christ at the Mount of Transfiguration. I don't know where they are. Maybe they travel like angels travel and they zap up to where God.
But the last
10
tribes weren't translated.
Well,
so
we don't
how
know
did they
happens.
Breathe in outer Maybe. Space, according to this theory? Do you
well, for
suppose?
All we know, a portion of them were righteous and were taken. We don't know what happened to them. But it sounds like Joseph Smith's implying that a portion of them became very righteous like Enoch and were translated. But I don't know. I've never heard that before.
There's a report, some guy named O.B. Huntington, that had this manuscript that Joseph Smith had drawn for him that showed the earth with two wings, kind of like two semicircles next to each other that gave the appearance of having these polar elongations. I mean, I'm trying to imagine it if it was like a circle splitting out of itself, kind of like an hourglass shape. And he described it as one dimension to another, that it's not like a physical difference. It's some dimensional difference. And so I've heard oftentimes, oh, they could be in another dimension. And that might speak, Mike, to your question about where the translated beings live. Or
well, you always wonder. I'm sorry. Yeah. You always wonder, like, when Moroni appeared in Joseph's room, it's like he stepped through a doorway. So now you're getting into how do angels travel, and is this the way that Enoch and his city travel to wherever they are now? Yeah. You know, how do angels move about? How do they suddenly appear in a closed room? Like when the Savior in his resurrected form just walked into the room where the apostles were. You know, how does that travel take place? And I think that's what maybe Joseph was trying to draw a picture of how they do it. I don't know.
I had a fantastic seminary teacher in high school who told me how he thought that some of this travel took place. He was from St. George, and he used to go with his family. They'd drive from St. George up to Salt Lake for a conference twice a year. And a couple of times he noticed in the sky a UFO, and he saw it coming up out of the mountains as they were leaving St. George, and it was a spaceship, and he was surprised to see it coming out of the mountains instead of coming like down out of the sky. And then when they got back from General Conference, it was landing in the mountains again. And so he thought, and you know, this wasn't something he was teaching the whole class. This was something he was telling me kind of in private afterwards, because I expressed an interest in lost tribes and he opened up his crazies for me, but you know, suggested, I think it tied to this hollow earth theory that he told me that he believed that he thought that the lost tribes were in the earth, but that they had not gone through an apostasy like we had gone through an apostasy. And so they didn't have all of the wars and destruction that we've had, that have set technology back. That they have a more advanced technology, and that they're just biding their time. They're in contact with the prophets and the brethren. And when the Lord says come back, they're going to come back. But they do have their prophets, but their prophets answer to our prophets. And you know, it's an extension of our church. It's the underground.
But they have a shortage of cows, apparently. They need
maybe.
Our cows.
Maybe.
And why are they performing anal exams on rednecks?
those are the bad ones.
The bad tribes.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so tell them a level set. You know what? what's clear, I think, from Mormon theology, and we kind of brushed through it really quick, is the 10 tribes are not completely dispersed. Well, they might be now, but at some point historically they were a real entity, and they were so real that Jesus Christ went and visited them, and they were so real that John the Beloved visited them as a kind of a three Nephite-ish sort of guy, and they were so real that they had a unique set of scriptures that talked about their trials and travails, just like the Lamanites and the Nephites. We're all in agreement on those facts, right?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
And what I think is interesting, in the 19th century, even though the world was still a mysterious place, there was a tendency to place them in sort of this extra sort of fanciful thing. You know, Orson Pratt talks a lot about them being in the North Pole, and he talks about these hidden valleys. And we know Joseph, these things we talked about with the other planets and all that kind of
stuff. Well, wait, just to stop for a moment on the North thing. He was saying in the interview that North meant the extremities of where their maps ended. So when they went into exile, they're going off the known map that they had at that time into unknown lands. And that's what they mean by North. Did I hear that correctly in the interview?
Wait. Oh, you mean what? Dr. Benite?
Yes. Glenn, do you remember that part he's saying when they were sent north, yeah, that they were going off the map?
I don't remember it being specific to North. I remember when he was talking about this land called Ar-Sarath, that it's a combination of two words that essentially means the furthest extremity. Just someplace unknown. And that land Ar-Sarath is associated with North in Ezra.
So in all these talks we're having here where the tribes are in the north, what we're really saying is they're off the map. We don't know where they went. They went up north to unknown lands.
I would accept
that.
Yeah,
but I don't think that's common belief, though.
And anyway, now there are no places off the map.
Well, and Mormonism reintroduces the term north and introduces it in a literal sort of way, right? If you have modern revelation where they're popping in the word north, it's a far stretch, although some of our friends at farms do it all the time, to argue that this modern usage from a prophet who is raised in, you know, upper state New York would pull off this metaphoric definition from 2,500 years ago. I don't think that's fair. If Joseph Smith's having revelation, hears the word north, then there must be something about the word north. And we have this whole series of brethren from the pulpit talking about them coming down out of the north and talking about ice and polar caps and the North Pole.
Yeah, here's Joseph F. Smith who specifically says the North Pole.
I think
Orson Pratt. Yeah, Orson Pratt. Led to a land in the neighborhood of the North Pole.
Was this in the Seer?
Millennial Star, 1867. Okay.
And when you know, you've got in popular Mormon culture, in 1903, there's a guy named Lindelof who wrote a book about the lost tribes being discovered in the North Pole. And it's this kind of like journey adventure book. I haven't read it, but I'm dying to, where they go up and there's a king and a queen and, you know, they've had their troubles, but it's all based in the North Pole. So, and even what John and I referenced earlier, this cruise to go up to the, you know, exploration, try to find the opening to the hollow earth up in the north. I mean, this was 2006, 2007 that people were saying this. So there's clearly in the popular imagination within the church this idea that I still think is alive, but probably not as much as it used to be, that the tribes are somewhere in the north and that when they return, you know, the global warming is going to melt the ice caps and volcanoes are going to explode and you're going to see, okay, the ice is going to break away just like it says in the DNC and here they come. And maybe it'll be a discovery of people, but I think there's still that belief out there.
Well, and okay. Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to ask a different question in relation to all this. The importance of the bloodline. I've heard that it's very, very important, you know, that's what you're descended from. In the patriarchal blessing, you're from Ephraim or Manasseh. I even heard somebody on my mission said they were from the tribe of Levi. And everybody thought that was cool, you know, like getting his autograph. Ooh. But I don't know.
Well, let's you know what your job is in the kingdom.
Yeah.
Well, okay, Mike, maybe that's what you thought. But at the time, everybody thought that the patriarchs were actually telling you what your direct bloodline was. Your heritage.
Right. If you're part of that tribe, you have a job in the kingdom. So Ephraim's supposed to be the gatherers.
Well, and I also
Levi sets up the chairs.
They automatically also get to be bishops.
But I also remember a controversial thing back when I was young. There was the parents were both of the tribe of Ephraim, and then they had a son or a daughter or something like that that was from a different tribe. I don't remember what it was, and everybody thought that, oh crap, something's wrong. Maybe the child was not really
mixed up at the hospital.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, because they used to really think that they were the literal bloodline from the 10 tribes.
What do you mean used to? You guys are all talking used to because you're all former Mormons.
No, I'm saying used to because I don't know. I have from Orson Pratt where he says that it's very important that they not be so amalgamated as to lose all distinction of tribes, but each family will know the particular tribe to which it belongs, and thus the whole nation will be able to classify themselves into 10 distinct divisions.
Because the bloodline is important, because if we want to go with Mike's theory that they're amongst us, then the bloodline is not so important, right?
Right. Then you want the theory that Mike has that it's just your job.
No, the bloodline is important so they know that you're part of that covenant God made with Abraham, that you're tied in, that you have promises made to you and your family to be part of the kingdom of Christ.
That's transferred through blood?
Well, it's if you're of lineage and you can say, I can trace myself back to Abraham, you know the promises made to Abraham are made to you too. And so you know that you have that tie to Christ.
Well, how in the world would you know? Because you just said that, you know, it isn't.
Well, that's why we get patriarchal blessings, so that you can know you're part of this tribe and you're part of that covenant God made with Abraham.
But in seminary, we were taught that was figurative, like you said, that was, you know, your kind of your job title in the church, and that we were kind of adopted in. That's
well,
that's
when you were when you and John went to the temple and were sealed, was that a figurative or was that a literal sealing?
There's no wax involved.
So. I think it was.
At least not.
No,
not
you're literally sealed together as long as you honor that covenant. God will keep you together throughout time and all eternity.
Okay, Mike, you're taking a rather literalist view, and I'm only taking this because you represent the views of a lot of people out there. But how does this reconcile with the idea in the Articles of Faith that man will be punished for their own sins? I mean, you're talking about a very sort of God pays attention to who, like my great grandfather, 40 generations back was, and that's important to God as to whether or not I receive the priesthood. How do we reconcile that with the basic view of you're only being punished for your own sins?
Well, here's the thing. When you were sealed to Zilpha, God renewed that same promise that he will take care of your children and ensure that the gospel is made available to them, and all the promises made to Abraham will be made to your children too. That's why it's the new and everlasting covenant. It's
okay,
renewed every
it.
Time the covenant is entered into.
Mike, I agree with you, but isn't that a very anti-Christian message? I mean, isn't the message
very exclusive?
Yeah, I mean, why would it matter to my great-great-grandchildren what Zilpha and I did in the temple that day? Shouldn't they be judged for their own behaviors? Shouldn't they accept Jesus Christ or reject Jesus Christ on their own merits?
No, see, when the Book of Mormon came out, it has two purposes. One is to show unto the remnant of the house of Israel what great things the Lord had done to your fathers, and that they may know the covenants of the Lord, that they are not cast out forever. That's one.
But
the second one is that they know who Christ is.
That's the message to the Lamanites, right?
Yes, that they know the covenants that were made for their fathers. So that's the whole hearts of your fathers turning to the children and the children turning to the fathers. You want the covenants they had, and you want the covenants for your children as well. If you worship Christ, you worship him in the sense that you make a covenant with him to carry his name and bear his name and honor your God by your actions. That when you bring people to Christ, you bring them to the covenant. And that's this whole tribal thing. That's why these tribes are so important, so that you know that you're bound to God through the promises he's made.
So, Mike, in Mormon teachings, we are all, every human being, the literal offspring of our Father in heaven.
Spiritually, yes.
Based on what you're saying, is God more concerned about the well-being spiritually of some of those children more than others based on their ancestry?
Well, what you're doing is Christ has been the one whose name we're supposed to be tied to. And so all of us are meant to take on the name of Christ and bear that name and show the great things God has done. So God works through his people who are willing to make covenants with him. That's why all these missionaries are sent out. Come into the covenant. Get yourself in the name. Receive the blessings that are there for you. That's why we send out missionaries. That's why we do these patriarchal blessings. God works through his covenant people, the ones that are willing to take upon his name and bear his burden.
Does that make sense? The covenant was with Abraham.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't make sense.
What? Well,
not anymore.
What do you mean not anymore? It's the same. It's the everlasting covenant. It's the one that we've always worked with.
No, I've changed. You mean like Mormons?
Because I don't think Christians work with that. When Christ assigned
the apostles, Christ told the apostles, go out and baptize everyone. Get my name on them. Okay, that's the whole purpose behind Christ is bring them into the covenant, tie my name to them that I can bless them. And the Abrahamic covenant is just an extension of that. You tie that name of Christ to your family and get part of that covenant.
I think you're representing a traditional, more old-fashioned view in Mormonism that I think, frankly, a lot of Mormons, like our liberal friends here on the podcast today, would cringe at, Mike.
Yay for liberals.
Well, I'm reading off the title page of the Book of Mormon.
I understand.
First page. You open the book, there it is.
I'm not saying you're making stuff up, Mike. I'm with you, brother. But what I'm saying is I think the church has moved away from that, which kind of is the whole crux of this 10 tribes issue. The whole thing just today in the modern era sounds so silly. The whole thing is just, it just doesn't make any sense at all. Why does it matter? Why does it matter if that this certain group of people is in a place that God preserved? It just, with the gospel as it's taught by the church today from conference, none of this makes sense at all.
Well, John, let me give you an example of where it does matter and it does make sense. And, you know, I'm living in Japan, right? And none of the people around me, you know, very few exceptions, are Christian. You know, they all come out of this Buddhist Shinto tradition. That they're not Western culture at all. They have their own morals, they have their own ethics. But when you have somebody join the church and they start to learn the Mormon way of seeing the world, they see themselves as being outside of that. You know, if you start defining the world through the Abrahamic covenant, everybody in this country is outside of it. You know, sorry, you missed out on the party. You have to rely on those of us who have the truth to, you know, get you to where you want to go. Well, when the members join the church here and they get their patriarchal blessing and it tells them that they're of the tribe of Ephraim, there's still the same debate here. Does that mean literal or does that mean figurative? But they've got this belief, and it's not, you know, why. It's not that every member of the church believes this, but there's this belief that floats around out there that the Japanese are the lost tribes of Israel, and that when this group of lost tribes left Assyria, they traveled across to Japan. And they settled in Japan, and people look at the customs here, but then they went apostate. And now what the Mormons are doing, the missionary work, is reclaiming them and restoring what was once lost. And so the members that see that and accept that as part of their identity, it has tremendous personal meaning because God hasn't forgot them. That they do fit, you know, Zilpha mentioned at the beginning when we were talking how important it is to try and find yourself, locate yourself in this overall narrative. So you've got this, the Japanese members feel it, the Japanese missionaries that are over here doing the missionary work, they feel, yeah, I'm doing God's work. I'm restoring what was lost. That's what Mormonism does.
A lot of the ones you talked to. Restoration.
Yeah.
About two thirds of them are Manasseh in Japan, right?
What, Tom, did you find that?
I don't think so. I think there's a lot of Ephraim.
Tom, did you find the breakdown of the percentage of tribes like you were talking about?
No, I don't have the percentage, no.
Oh, because you were talking about the like in the Polynesia.
Oh, that was me.
Oh, sorry, yeah, so sorry.
That's what I was saying. According to the list I have, about two-thirds of the people in Japan are from Manasseh.
Oh, okay, you've got the list.
Yeah, Zilpha, yeah. Don't mix me and Mike up ever again. Just kidding.
You know, that's funny. You mentioned that, Glenn. Like I said, with the Southeast Asians, that sort of mythos was there also. But what's fascinating is, to return to my point, that's not what you'll hear from the pulpit. It's not what you'll read in the Enzen. But there is this subtext, this almost, you know, whisper campaign underneath that gives people identity that way, but you'll not hear it from the church, because from the church's view, the way they position themselves today, it doesn't matter. I mean, we're all children of our Father in heaven. We're all equal participants. You know, there's nobody anymore, at least not in the last 30 years, who's excluded based on their race or their heritage or their color or their skin.
But I agree with Glenn.
When they come over and they dedicate temples and they dedicate, you know, like when they're on local soil and they're speaking to even if it's the general authorities, I'd need to get some sources on this. But I would imagine that they still say things like this.
I would bet they do, because it gives the people a good feeling. And that's what they want to bring to the people, is a good feeling.
Well, I guess it's very much sort of like what goes on in South America. You know, the guys from farms and the apologists will try to very much minimize the idea that all South Americans are Lamanites. But in the South American countries, that message is loud and clear, and it shows up in the dedicatory prayers. Right. And it's you know, all through Polynesia, that's the common belief. And members, from what I'm told, take a great deal of identity from the fact that they are literal descendants of the Nephites and Lamanites.
Yeah.
I guess that says it all. Thanks for playing.
Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, the whole point of this is that we're going to tie the family together. We're all part of that family, and God doesn't receive honor and glory until we say we've put to the test the things you've taught us, and it works. And we are bound together as a family because of what you taught us. And then you give glory to God, because his whole family is tied together and exalted.
But still,
I always think it's ridiculous, Mike, when we put these conditional limits on God, you know, that he doesn't get his glory until we do our thing.
How does God receive glory? If God's teachings don't work, then how does he get glory? If we put to the test the things he taught us. Yes, but we glorify him by being exalted ourselves. That gives glory to God. We've done what you said, and look what happened to us.
Does he need more glory?
Well, that's his work and his glory, to bring us exaltation. He says so in the scriptures. This is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and exaltation of man. This is what gives God glory, is that when his teachings affect us and we're exalted by it. And then
so
we can,
I guess,
glorify
God. He's not quite omnipotent then.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Well,
he relies on us to get some of that power. He can't do it himself.
Yeah, I hope next time around, my God is not so emotionally needy as the one we have right now.
I don't understand.
You mean
what
when
you're
reincarnated? What do you mean the next time around?
You know, next time,
next world.
Emotionally needy. I don't get that at all.
Thou shalt have no other gods before me.
Okay, this is just a small piece of advice, Mike. You can take it or leave it. I think it would be helpful if you would just not present your opinion as absolute. In fact,
it is absolute.
Well, your opinion, okay. It's definitely your opinion.
Well, even with the 10 tribes, I mean, even within Mormonism, like we've already discussed, there's plenty of faithful believing LDS members that do think that, you know, they're down in the core of the earth, or they're on some planet somewhere else. Your opinion differs with them, but they still have a temple recommend with the barcode and everything, just like you do. So,
and they probably have more scriptural backup than yours does.
And so do I, by the way.
So Tom, you think Mike ought to say his opinions as opinions rather than facts?
Yeah, instead of force feeding it and presenting it as absolute truth. I mean, when it comes to stuff like this, Mike, these are just opinions. I mean, you're not going to get your recommend yanked and stuff like that. There's too many differing opinions. And yes, there's plenty of people that, like Dr. Benai said, the majority opinion is this is all just mumbo jumbo, this whole 10 types thing. So
yeah, he sounded real faithful.
I like what he said. What was the quote? When faith, hold on, I want to run and get it because I want to reiterate it.
While you're finding that, I just wanted to make the point that when you look at Isaiah's language, this highway and the waters and stuff, that the water refers to the gospel being taught. And so
according to Mike.
According to Isaiah.
Oh, when ready?
Is that like the in the Book of Revelations, the waters that come out? Is that the same?
Right.
Because I heard that before. Like the waters is a symbol of the gospel being taught to people.
Yeah, you compare DNC 133 to Isaiah 35, and Isaiah 35 explains that the waters are the gospel. Yeah. Go ahead, Zilpha.
Go ahead, Zil.
Oh, well, he said, and I think this speaks to Mormonism in particular, because we have modern revelation, and I think this comes up a lot. When faith clashes with science, sometimes you need a new revelation.
Yeah.
To make it work.
Or you need a new prophet or going to a different direction. Yeah.
Right.
That was good.
And I really liked what he said at the end of the interview when I talked to him about the, the North Star thing and Joseph pointing out into space. And he said that sounded exactly what he would expect from a prophet. You know, he didn't put it down. He just said that a prophet is very poetic. They speak figuratively. And they speak about things that are outside of the realm of understanding. So it made perfect sense to him. And I think, you know, in his own faithless, Mike, way, he did kind of leave the interview open that Joseph Smith might have been onto something. That there's this river called the Sambatyon River that, this is really outside of Mormon stories about the lost tribes, but the Sambatyon is the river that separates the lost tribes from the rest of the world. And Dr. Benite goes into the etymology of Sambatyon, and he thinks that it has to do with the planet Saturn, which also meant the end of things. You know, like Saturday is the end of the week, and so he thought that Sambatyon was symbolic of being someplace out in space as far as you could get from anywhere else, you know, like the planet Saturn would have been the fringe of the galaxy at that point. So he says if Joseph Smith somehow understood that even anciently people believed that the lost tribes were in the outer space, he either came across this by accident or he really knew what was going on. So
that was a really good part of the interview. I liked that part. Yeah. That was good.
I imagine you would.
Glenn.
Well, it'd be interesting to find out if one of these lost tribes did remain faithful and were translated, because that would make sense out of a lot of that stuff.
That would be awesome.
That would indeed be interesting. Yeah. Glenn, you have a farms you have a farms article with your name on it. I can hear feel coming out of this one.
I have a what?
A farms article. All right. I think to sum it all up, I think in the modern church, most people would take this stuff as very metaphoric, but there are those out there, a la my father-in-law, who take it very literal, and it's still there in the church. And I think it is a problem for the church, because it is something that was sort of a metaphorical fringe teaching that Joseph made concrete. And, you know, here I got the 10th article of faith in front of me. We believe in the literal gathering of Israel and in the restoration of the 10 tribes. The Zion, the New Jerusalem, will be built upon the American continent. And that's something we didn't even go into, that it's a necessary teaching. Not only are the 10 tribes going to be restored, but they're going to be restored to the United States as opposed to Israel. We didn't get much into that. But so I think it's sort of, for me, it's symbolic of the whole relationship and the problem that Mormonism has as it grows up and gets older and tries to negotiate itself with the rest of the world, that there's many things in the Christian world and the Bible that can easily move inside and outside that literal and metaphoric world. But because of the way it was framed by early church apostles, Mormonism is bound to that. And we have to oftentimes ignore and hide and contextualize via people like Farms, all this old stuff, to make it sound like it wasn't there. So I think Mormonism still has some growing up to do that way, and I think this whole thing sort of hints at that, where the 10 tribes, if you take the old prophets, it has to be literal and it has to be real, and the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants both hinge on them being an actual physical people in some place.
John, do you connect this at all to the signs of the times and the way that people are kind of moving away from, looking at signs of the times? You think that's happening?
Yeah, I think you and I were talking a few weeks ago about the Cold War and how literal a lot of that stuff was growing up. And I don't know. I don't know if it's me moving out of those circles or the church moving away from it, or it's the passing of the year 2000. And, you know, when I was a kid in the 70s and 80s, 2000 was the end, man. That was it.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm looking forward to 2012.
Yeah, that's the next one.
So I think so. You know, as I did, I don't know about the rest of you, but as I did research into this, Ten Tribes, most of the writing was very much connected with writing on prophecies and end times. But that's, you know, outside the scope of what we can talk about in this hour.
Yeah.
All right. Any last thoughts, guys?
Thanks, Glenn, for coming on, bro. And getting Dr. Benite. That was awesome.
Yeah. Well, thanks, you guys. I enjoyed it. It's fun.
It adds prestige to the podcast when we get you professor types on.
I'm an apostate professor.
Oh, you can repent.
Yeah, I left. I'd still want to.
Come back home. We want you.
Yeah. No, he means he's an apostate as a professor. He left academia. He still has a temple recommend.
Yeah,
okay. I'm still teaching.
I'm a temple
Sunday
recommend holding apostate professor.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. To those who listen to this podcast, I do want to point out there's five of us here, and three of us currently hold temple recommends. So.
Yeah.
So there.
Yeah, so we're not all heathens. We disagree, but we can all go into the same holy temples, right?
Yeah. All right. As always, the discussion continues on our website. Find us at mormonexpression.com. You can send us an email at mail@mormonexpression.com. Call us at 801-906-6722. And be sure to check us out on Facebook. Our group is over there. You can search for Mormon Expression.